It's the My Michelle Live Podcast.
My Michelle Live.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for joining us today, My Michelle Live. Thank you, big voice guy. Yeah, a little My Michelle Live theme music. Right as we take you into, or out of, I was better to say, the week of news, crazy stuff, all of the news that's going on out there. What do you do but talk about it? Give what we like to do on this segment or on this particular podcast is take you to a place of a little deeper understanding, looking at some of the news stories, some news behind the news, giving it context that you don't get anymore. If the news, all of the newspapers and all of the news outlets did their job, I don't know if we'd need this segment. Yeah, we would, because it's so much fun, because it is the Riz Report.
Let's review the week. The Riz Report with Adam Ruzzieri.
Hey, hey, happy week, everybody. Happy week, Michelle.
Hey, happy week. Happy end of the week. Congratulations. High five. You made it to the end.
We made it, and it's like, okay, weekend mode, turn that on. Let's get busy, right?
Let's get busy with it. Look, we have come to the end of another week. Great, good for us. In this week, there have been some very interesting news stories that are most definitely worth going into. And we're going to go into some of them. And even some of the, this has been a fun week as well, because there's been, some celebrations. Both religious, secular, and some things that are kind of in between.
There really have been some celebrations this week and this month too, right? So for all of our Muslim friends out there, Ramadan Mubarak, everybody. Your holy month is coming to a conclusion, I believe, next week with the 3-day Eid celebration. We don't want to wish you guys the best for that. For the non-Muslims out there, a little bit of education. Ramadan started about 1400 years ago. This isn't like their first rodeo by any means. And it includes daily fasting and prayer to really kind of remind those who celebrate this just of the suffering of those who are less fortunate than them. It just helps you appreciate things a little bit differently and a little bit more. As part of Ramadan, abstain from things like smoking, caffeine, no sexy time, abstain from gossip, none of that kind of stuff. And really after your sunset prayers, obviously people gather with their friends and family for a feast called iftar. So Ramadan Mubarak, everybody. I guess in addition to that being a big deal, obviously this past month and certainly going into next week, this week specifically, it was a May the 4th be with you kind of week, and also a Cinco de Mayo sort of week.
Woo-hoo!
There were a couple things going on there.
Right? I know it. You know, which one are you a little more leaning towards celebrating? Are you more?
I'm going to give you a clue. You ready?
Yeah.
You know, and so that was my best effort at a greet, though. No, I'm just kidding. That was not me. I got to give the credit to the Yerba Buena Garden Festival YouTube account. Thank you for that excellent, excellent example of the classic grito. Obviously, in Texas, you know, we really do love ourselves some Cinco de Mayo. You know, nothing to be saying, you know, no haters or negativity towards May the 4th be with you. That's cool.
Hey, too. Well, you know, because that's a big thing, too.
As well it should be. As well it should be. I love Cinco de Mayo. And yeah, May 4th is cool too, but Cinco de Mayo, man. Now a lot of Americans are like, oh, that's Mexican Independence Day. No, not exactly. It's not quite even like the Independence Day here in the US. That for Mexico, it's September 16th. That's the independence from Spain. Cinco de Mayo celebrates the Mexican army's victory over France at the Battle of Puebla. And this wasn't just a couple years ago. This was 1862, which was a crazy year if you really think about 1862. I mean, there was the American Civil War going on. That's crazy. Obviously, there was war happening in Mexico itself. But at Cinco de Mayo, we had General Ignacio Zaragoza, who led the battle he basically led troops at the Battle of Puebla for Mexico. This guy, though, this general was actually born in Texas. Of course, I have to remind everybody here, right? Texas used to be part of Mexico, but of course, Texas was also its own country, right? Texas is great. And y'all are welcome here anytime. But in a nutshell, actually, General Zaragoza recruited hundreds of Texans to fight in this battle. So, you know, today, though, it's kind of like St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. Like, Cinco de Mayo isn't quite as huge in Mexico as we try to make it here in the U.S. I mean, you have people in Texas and California, Colorado, all, you know, different parts of the United States that really make Cinco de Mayo a thing. Now, I've celebrated St. Patrick's Day in Ireland specifically. And as the Americans,
they don't care.
Yeah, like as the Americans were running around with green, you know, we're just like, yeah, Guinness, let's have a good time. And, you know, it's kind of like Cinco de Mayo in Mexico. It's less of a thing than we make it here in the States. You know, but the first American Cinco de Mayo was actually, it was kind of back in 1863, and it was just an expression of solidarity with Mexico. Obviously, things were really crazy back then. And before we went live, Michelle and I were just talking about it, and we were just like, can you imagine living back in like the 1860s? I mean, if you don't die by a bullet, like, you know, it's dysentery, or it's like anything from the Oregon Trail game, like, could take you down. It's just like no air conditioning. I mean, shoot, no internet. I mean, man, that's gotta be a hard time to live through, you know?
It is amazing that during that time, and part of that celebration is this great big battle, and that's great. Again, in Mexico, not such a big deal, just like in Ireland, St. Patrick's Day, but boy, do we get a chance to culturally appropriate here in the United States, and I'm surprised they didn't take that away from us. Like, what, yes, what right do you have to eat tacos and don a sombrero? But it's a big deal. It's a big deal down there in Texas. It's a minor
to celebrate here. Right, well, yeah. it's an important thing to celebrate diversity in your background and your culture and the things that make us awesome and different, but also like the same, right? We can all appreciate amazing Mexican food. I love Mexican food, I love Mexican music, I love Mexican culture. Maybe it's because I'm from Texas, right? Maybe. But I will say, Michelle, growing up in Texas and having a really strong exposure to Mexican culture, before I married my wife, I traveled to meet the in-law or the future in-laws in southern Maine. Went to a Mexican restaurant, and I noticed that the word tortilla was not spelled correctly. I also noticed that the word quesadilla on the menu was spelled incorrectly.
How did they spell it?
That was a red flag. The I's weren't in the right places, and the O's and the A's were off. And I was just like, man, you know what? Who's making the food at this Mexican restaurant? It was French Canadians, not Mexicans.
Oh, you know, look, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you something. I live near Canada. Okay, I'm in Seattle. It's only a hop, skip, and a jump up to the beautiful city of Vancouver, British Columbia, right? Big, beautiful cool city. If you're going to go up to Canada, enjoy Canada, but don't go to a Mexican restaurant. I'm sorry. There may be some good ones up there. If there are, I stand corrected. Send me those Mexican restaurants and your opinion. But I got to tell you, when you go and I've been to quite a few, ordering salsa, that stuff is ketchup with maybe a tiny bit of chili powder in it. And you're going, what is this?
Right.
Oh yeah. And so I'm there with, I'm sorry, Hagee, my very, very good friend, we're at this restaurant and she's like, this is the best salsa ever, but it really has a bite to it. And I'm like, Norwegian girl, what am I going to do with you?
Well, it's like when you go to Mexico and you order salsa or queso, you're going to get shredded cheese and pico de gallo. You're not going to get salsa as we in Tex-Mex, right? Tex-Mex is different from Mexican food. Salsa is a liquid, like delicious, like sauce that you dip chips in, right? Queso is a delicious melted cheese that's going to make you feel great in the moment and maybe not so great the next day, but it's delicious. So yeah, I mean, when you go to different parts of the country, right, and you understand sort of how people have immigrated across our country, obviously the backgrounds are different. And the way a French Canadian interprets Mexican food is going to be very different from how a Texan expects Mexican food to be, because we know.
Exactly.
It's those holes in the walls where there's very little English spoken. Like those more obscure places in Dallas that you just have to sort of know about. Not the mainstream locations, but that's where you find the best tamales and the best Mexican food that's out there. It's those places that are lesser known.
There you go.
But if you're in the know, you know.
If you're in the know, you know. I'm telling you, some of the best. Oh my goodness, I love Tex-Mex. It's my jam now. And as we talk about, you know, reviewing the week, and of course Cinco de Mayo and such, it's a reminder. My family, I have a kind of a cool background. We confuse Cinco de Mayo with the Mexican Revolution and some of the happenings in and around 1910. Right, mm-hmm. Cinco de Mayo and all of that. Hullabaloo happened, you know, in the 1800s, 1910. My grandfather rode with Pancho Villa.
That is
rode with Pancho Villa. He was part of the ruling class. He was, you know, this privileged guy, and he chose to ride with Pancho Villa, who actually, interestingly enough, was kind of the owner of a part of the northern part of,
right,
of
Chihuahua.
Mexico. Yeah,
which is actually that's where El Chapo came from originally.
Some pretty bad guys.
Well, like, yeah, but you know, but also just beautiful. Also from just the geography, the topography, the people themselves.
The people some themselves, real yeah.
Beauty to parts of Chihuahua, Mexico, and also one of my favorite when I was a kid. One of my favorite Dallas Mavericks. He was a guy who was I kind of related to as an athlete. His name was Eddie Nájera from Chihuahua, Mexico. And he was like this guy on the Dallas Mavericks who hustled real hard to get the job done. I think he ended up playing for the Denver Nuggets for a while. But as an athlete, I never had a lot of natural talent, but I tried real hard. And so I could relate to the hustle that Eddie Nájera showed as an athlete. And I was like, well, at least I have that part of it.
I love it.
You know, but no, I love just kind of the history there. I would love to learn more about kind of the background there with Pancho Villa, though, because that is just a huge thing, Michelle.
I'm blown away by that history, and knowing that my grandfather met my grandmother, who was kind of a peasant girl there in Mexico. I saw her picture for the first time. I might even find it and pull it up, because I never met these people. They lived so far, you know, removed from me. My dad being in the family of the youngest of 15 kids, I think his siblings were grandparents before he had me. But to think that they spent their wedding night in a tree hiding Whoa. From the soldiers back in that time. Yeah, just astounding stories. And then got citizenship in the United States. He had this very strong love for America and the opportunity, even though he came from privilege, came to this country with nothing but a signet ring that showed his background and a Stradivarius violin. His wife, probably a couple of kids. He named his first son, one of his sons, Francisco, who, you know, after Pancho Villa, which was his first name. Amazing though, his love for this country and the opportunity, so much so that here I am with this Hispanic background and I barely speak Spanish. And you think, why? Well, the reason is back then the idea was you're in America. We speak English, you know, at home with grandma, that's fine. Yeah. And there's part of that culture that you never lose, but that culture merges with the culture of the United States and appreciation. You speak English, you speak it properly, and you speak it with respect, because this country welcomed you with open arms. We want to contribute to it. And I love that mindset. Part of that, you know, it just never goes away.
Michelle, it sounds like basically your family and my family became Americans around the same time in the very, very early 1900s.
What?
So Alessandro Rizzieri, my great-grandfather, came over in Ellis Island as a 19-year-old, speaking no English. He had literally like a couple dollars to his name and just a suitcase. Like that was it. And showed up at Ellis Island, and it actually took him two tries to get in. Didn't make it the first try. And so a lot of the Rizzieri family ended up in Argentina, and then a lot of the Rizzieri family ended up in upstate New York and speaking zero English, but learning English, having, a life that was a harder life dedicated to just work so that the next generation could have something better. Working as a janitor overnight, helping his kids just get an education, stay on the straight and narrow path by keeping the family intact, focusing on education, on love for God and religion, and all the things that really matter overall in life. Because the truth is you can work towards something better in our country. It's not given to you, but you got to work for it. And when you work for it, good things follow, you know? From families like ours, families that have immigrated here to our country, you know, what's the result of that? You look towards the second and third generation Americans. You have business owners, you have entrepreneurs, you have doctors, you have lawyers, you have politicians, you have homemakers. I mean, you have Americans who contribute to the beauty of our society, that think freely and contribute. And it's a desire and it's an appreciation too for those who lived in times past that were harder. I can't imagine living in the freaking 1860s with like no air conditioning and awful diseases and no antibiotics. Like if you cut yourself on a rusty fence, like you might die from like an infection. Whereas today we just get Neosporin, you know?
And so, you know, we're dealing with wars, famines, pestilence, little understanding of some kinds of medicine. We're dealing with you know, just regular getting a toothache or decay in your tooth could lead to death. We're dealing with some hardcore stuff, and here we are, not to minimize the destruction of the coronavirus, the deaths that have occurred, because it's real, but we've been so far removed from that kind of thing that even for the 98% of folks that, you know, get it and completely recover, we are living in a bit of fear. And I don't want to minimize it, but Adam, we're living in a fear because we have been so spoiled and padded and prosperous. We don't really get what it's like to have to deal with the death and pestilence in the way they did back in the day. No wonder it was a little bit easier when you're going through hard times to bend your knee and ask for a little divine intervention. Well, now, you know, we've got vaccines, we've got science. We don't really need God. At least that's what the president might think here.
Right.
That's a news story, folks. Did you hear?
It is crazy. Even those scientists who are involved in, so like I was listening to your show on gene therapy, you know, like, man, even scientists that can control parts of life at a very minute molecular level, there's still an appreciation for the unknown. And the reality is the explanation is God. I mean, that's just it. Like there's not a scientific explanation for many things in this world. And you know what? Maybe we're not supposed to get it all, you know, and that's okay, right? I mean, that's definitely okay, because that's where faith comes in. And thank goodness, right? Otherwise, that's a lot of weight to carry. You know, that's a lot of weight to carry. It's a huge burden. Michelle, there was National Prayer Day this week. And this Thursday, it was yesterday, was the 70th annual occurrence of National Prayer Day. And National Prayer Day originally hit our country in 1952 when President Truman signed a bill proclaiming National Prayer Day into law. And President Reagan, you know, the date was originally April 17th, but like when you do it that way, you know, sometimes the 17th falls on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. It's different days of the, depending on the year. So Reagan tried to simplify it and said, you know what, guys, 1988, we're going to start calling the first Thursday of May every year as National Day of Prayer. So here's the story. President Biden chose to omit the word God from the National Prayer Declaration, which is a little weird, right? Because I mean, who are you praying to, man? Like, where's that? Where is it going? Yeah, praying, it's like there's no address on the envelope, you know? Where are we going? Obama mentioned God. Every president historically has mentioned God, right?
Yeah, actually, this is the very first time in United States history that God was omitted from the National Day of Prayer. In fact, I think you even sent me some statistics on how many times recent presidents have mentioned God.
Right. Yeah. It's not like a whisper or like a quick like afterthought, right? Obama mentioned God in 2017 and 2018. Trump mentioned God 5 times each. 2019, up to 7 times. There were 11 mentions of God in 2020 by President Trump. So, you know, and it's not about counting like, oh, well, this year God was used more times than that year. It's not about that. It's just about the intentions behind it. So, you know, when that decision was made by President Biden or his people to exclude the word God from the prayer, I think that we're entitled to ask a lot of questions about why. And, you know, I think some might say that by mentioning God, it might alienate those who maybe don't believe in God. But the thing is America was founded with faith. That's kind of what started our country. If you look to those who were involved in the revolution against the British, you know, there were a lot of faith leaders that were a part of that. You had people who led the church also leading communities and bringing people together and doing so with the knowledge that the king is not the end all be all of our lives. There is something greater than the king. And so it's okay to rebel against that which is unjust, because there are things that God actually intended for you to have as inalienable rights. Mm. And so it was really, really kind of like
awkward,
eye-opening, I guess, Michelle. Awkward is, yeah, awkward AF, right? Like, like, why are we, what's the angle here, right? What's the reason? Is it to be inclusive by excluding? I mean, there's nothing in my mind that legitimizes or explains the absence of God.
I mean, what's the point? Then don't have a national day of prayer, or have your own. And this is a problem, how we like to change things. You know, if you don't want to have a national, if you don't like prayer, fine. Have a national day of happy thoughts. Have a national day of positive thinking. I don't mind that. It's not that it's helpful, not quite as powerful, in my opinion, as prayer. And yet, go ahead and do it. But it's as though, no, we have to change it. It's kind of like in our country and having a more libertarian thought. I'm not, whatever you want to do as an adult, whoever you marry, okay, or who you want to be with is your choice. Okay, fine. Let's just make that the way things are. But why does it have to be called marriage? Why? You know, why cannot marriage, which has been traditionally between a man and a woman, be marriage? Call it something else. Call it an exquisite union, whatever you want to call it. You know, why does it have to impede on something else? And I think in the same way with prayer, instead of just these accolades, just pray. You don't want to pray. No one's making you pray. That is the essence of a free country. You may not like it, but it's someone's right. Leave it alone. Live and let live, so to speak. I thought it might be interesting to include some thoughts from Franklin Graham. He was asked on the Fox News report what he thought about the omission of God from Joe Biden's speech. I think what he's saying is kind. As I set the stage, it is giving Joe Biden the benefit of the doubt, but I think it's revealing some other things that may be concerning in this soundbite. Take a listen.
It's probably a staff person that wrote it, and let's maybe hope. Not even ran it by him. I don't, because I don't think Joe Biden would have approved that one. This is the National Day of Prayer. Of course, we need to call on God, not just some generic gods or some power in the air, on God himself, the creator, who made and created this earth and who sent his son, Jesus Christ, from heaven to this earth to save mankind from sin by dying on a cross. And God raised him to life. And there's no one else to pray to except to God. And for Joe Biden to miss that, I just think maybe it was a staffer that did that and he wasn't even aware. So I would like to give the benefit of the doubt to President Biden.
So that was kind of him to want to give the benefit of the doubt to President Biden. And that could be the case because, you know, Joe might be, you know, he's proven to be a little old school. However, as kind as that is and as nice of a pass as that is, people, he's the president of the United States. You have a responsibility, you know, proofread your speech. I think I mentioned this. I really loved that someone had posted this on his page that, Joe, why don't you just turn the monitor around and let us read it? It might make more sense that way. And
I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw that. You know, I saw the, when Reverend Graham was kind of like saying those words, you know, yesterday on Pete Hegseth's program, excuse me. And, right on. I mean, right on. It's like that. It's like that address, or it's the envelope with no address. I mean, where is this prayer going?
Yeah.
You know, and you want to give the guy the benefit of the doubt. And Michelle, I know, you know, last week in our episode, we were talking about how, you know, maybe President Biden truly is more of a technocrat that just kind of does what he thinks he's supposed to do. Sort of, you know, you point him this way and he walks that way. You point him that way and he goes that way now. Instead of a guy who's really principled and working based on an ideology that he really feels in a very strong way. So if that's the case, then it's like, yeah, he probably just read the thing that the handlers gave him. He's like, oh, this is the paper. This is the prayer. Okay, I'm going to read this because that's what I was told to do and that's what I'm expected to do. Whereas if you had done the same with a past president, it could have been Obama, it could have been Trump. That is a president who's going to look at the paper and say, nah, something's missing here. Maybe we should add a few words, like this one word in particular, God, guys. But that's a different kind of president, right? That's a president that really is conducting himself in these perspectives as someone who believes in certain principles and values and is going to adhere to those and not just allow a handler to give them a piece of paper to read. The thing that I think about, Michelle, is I think about a lot of the moves that we've seen kind of as institutions in our society have kind of in some ways consolidated, in other ways they've become less free too. And I think we definitely have a good topic that we'll kind of find ourselves in here in a bit. But the reality is when you look at some of the socialist kind of moves that have taken place in our society, we have to recognize that the step beyond socialism is communism, and religion cannot exist under a communist sort of structure. There is a difference between socialism and communism, and we are not in a communist society by any means. The main difference is that with socialism, it's compatible with small doses of democracy and liberty, but in communism, it involves creating an equal society through a truly authoritarian state. The problem is there is no equal society when you have a dictator on top and a ruling class on top of the working class. It's not really an equal society. Now, speaking more towards the kind of founding principle of religion not meshing well with the extreme of socialism being communism, look at the words of Karl Marx, right? He said that, he has this quote, and it's kind of a popular quote. The simplified version of it is, religion is the opium of the people.
Yeah.
Now, the full quote of that is, religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. So what does that really mean? It means that you can't have revolutions take place if people are on opium. People are distracted. They're not worried about the society as it is. They trust in sort of the overall, they trust in the fact that, you know, diversity is okay. And that right now, as you see these moves of critical race theory trying to indoctrinate our classrooms and creating these classes of oppressor and oppressed, well, then in that case, you basically are talking about getting rid of the respect for diversity of thought and diversity of backgrounds and cultures and religions. So when you have something like that in play, it kind of gets in the way of a socialist revolution actually taking place. When you look at America and religion from a historical perspective, we know that religion played a key role just in establishing the colonies, right? New England. Mm-hmm. Those colonies were largely composed or comprised of people that were exiled for their religious beliefs, right? They left England because they could not be free. Now, kind of flash forward just a little bit, a couple decades or a few decades, maybe a couple hundred years too, the role of religion in the American Civil Rights Movement, right? We're talking about the 1960s and the years leading up to that. The church represented the freedom that Americans were promised originally in the Declaration of Independence. So America was not founded as a country that wasn't designed to allow for basically equality, right? Thomas Jefferson was very intentional about what he wrote in the Declaration of Independence. The words are this, right? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So he gave this phrase of three examples of truly unalienable rights. And these are all given to humans by their creator. And so governments are expected to protect that. And it was basically in the mid 20th century with the civil rights movement, we saw Black Christian thought leaders coming from the churches being those who said, hey guys, we were promised something in the Declaration of Independence, and we're not quite there yet, right? Like, a promise was made, and America is great. America is great because we have an ability to ensure that it lives up to its promise. And so as one nation under God, we had these committed, thoughtful religious thought leaders, Martin Luther King Jr. and many, many others, who basically ensured that our society was delivering on its promise. Without religion being something that those people could have turned to for strength and also just for support as well, man, like, where would we be? You know, we probably wouldn't be living in such a free, great society. You wouldn't have generations of people, second and third generation Americans, now finding themselves as leaders, right? Like politicians and doctors and lawyers and business owners and just happy homemakers too, right? I mean, pursuing happiness, living life that would not have been possible without just the founding principles of our country.
Indeed, and the it is illogical and without understanding to think that our nation, Adam, could operate as it has been said by our founding fathers without a holy and religious people. That's a thought. Now, these are the people who put the Constitution in place. What do they mean by that? Think about that. It's to have a holy and I think that's the quote. I'm going to look it up because it.
I mean, what do they mean by that? Right. It's kind of like this respect, right? It's like this respect between the people, the government as a.
I really should remember that quote. I'm sorry about that. So, yeah.
Well, but I mean, it's really just about like looking at the government as a tool that protects rights that were given to us by God. These unalienable rights, the government is there to protect those, right? And so when you talk about, you know, majority rule, minority rights, there's respect for those who lose a vote. And that's just the bottom line. When you lose that sort of respect, when you lose the function of government protecting minority rights and protecting diversity,
there you go.
We have an authoritarian situation going down, and that is not good.
Yeah.
And that's not for any country, but that's not how we were founded. That's not how we're made.
All right. So I want to give a little Michelle perspective on this. And my head was somewhere else, so I didn't remember. Google makes me look smart. Thank you, Google. John Adams, and it was his quote saying that our Constitution was made only. Now think about this. These are the folks who put this together. You know, it's kind of like mom making dinner and she makes it just the way the family likes it, you know, and let's just say it. This is how I made it. This is who it was made for. This is who's going to prosper by eating it, whatever. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Why is that? Because if you are a country of, by, and for we the people, and arguably we have more freedom, more opportunity in this nation for everybody, even the oppressed, even those who feel like they are underprivileged, you still have more rights, more opportunity than any other time in world history under this thing that we have here in the United States of America. But if we don't have that recognition of God, then where does our morality come from wherever we want? Because if there is no God, there is no ultimate good. And secondly, it speaks to what you're saying, Mr. Adam. It is saying that we have a devaluation of life, because what are we? We're really just these freaks of a happenstance that crawled out of the goo. We have no future. We have no one to be accountable to. So our appreciation for human life is completely diminished. And it's diminished in the way people talk to each other on Facebook. It's diminished in the way that we treat each other. It's diminished in the way that we hold our responsibilities. It's diminished in the way we have a national day of prayer, for crying out loud.
It's nuts. It's nuts. It's like, where does it stop, right? Where does it stop? And the scary thing that I'm observing, Michelle, there's literally now a term that is being kicked around by some of the ruling, those in power right now. I don't want to say the ruling elites, but I'm kind of what it is. So, and I'm sure I'm probably on a list somewhere for this one, but it's called patriotic extremism. And so there are literally people who are coming from the way, way left. Like, these are not Democrats. These are people coming from the way left of political philosophical thought. And anyone who's libertarian in nature, who loves America, who loves diversity and appreciates diversity and loves what it does, which, what does diversity do? It yields innovative, creative, great things, whether it's products, services, or interactions. I mean, it's like one of the things that makes our country so freaking cool, you know, is our respect for diversity of thought and the way we use it to be amazing. Like, we are the best country in the world for a reason, and it's because of that. So now you have people that are in positions of leadership as part of the current administration who are labeling and kind of keeping notes and keeping logs of people that are like us and that love America and love freedom and appreciate what it means. But we're called basically patriotic extremists. And we are now basically being kind of viewed as literally just those with extreme views. But the thing is when you look at statistics and you look at just the last election, I mean, that's half the country that you're basically pointing at and saying, man, you carry an extreme ideology. But an extreme is an extreme, right? It's not part of a majority or even a half, right? An extreme implies that it's far over here or far over there, or it's on the fringe, right?
Yeah. So I think another implication, to be fair, in modern conversation is extreme also has an implication of extreme actions that can be associated with it. And I think we can see that when we look at some of the Al-Qaeda jihadist kind of mindsets, even if it doesn't have, even if they had the majority of numbers, their way of executing their ideas are quite extreme. So that has another implication as well. Oh, and yeah, because of that implication, when you call someone extreme, it's easy to demonize them at Hitlerum and to put them at a place of, you're not only have a view that is, you know, outside of what I think is the norm, but you're dangerous. And that in itself, to me, is dangerous. I'm going to use an example. This last week, I posted something that was controversial on my Facebook page, right? By the way, can I back up and just say once again, I have been canceled on Facebook. Now, wow. I wasn't canceled because of a controversial post, which I'll get to. It was a post of a flagpole with the flag was a mask, and it said mask of slavery. And I asked for thoughts and a question mark. Why? Because I wanted to get people's ideas, both sides, to share on my show. I thought it would be interesting. It became it got really ugly from at least two people who attacked me personally. How dare you, you know, post this kind of a thing, and you're QAnon and you're this. It's like, dude, I just asked for thoughts, you know, but how dare you?
You literally started a social science survey, Michelle. That was just a social science survey right there.
It was crazy. One woman in particular was so obsessed. Like, she was posting a couple of times a day. And one post was, I told my dad about you, and he's asked why you know her and how you know her. I'm like, I'm getting to the point where you got to tell daddy on me. But but it was just a post. Or I saw, you know, you've had other controversial things. You were posting yourself shooting a gun. Yes, exercising my constitutional right. How extreme is that? Now, I say that to say that we have come to a point, and we'll talk about some of the things happening with social media, because there's some news stories associated. We're at a point where we cannot even talk anymore, where there's such a divide, and Facebook plays into it. I wasn't canceled for that post, Adam. Why was I canceled? Because on Monday's show, do more than music. It's a segment, if you haven't seen it, that is absolutely outside of my comfort zone. I don't like talking about me so much. I like talking with people like you, but I play some original music and maybe some music that maybe a cover. Or in Monday's case, Adam, it was an old hymn called How Deep the Father's Love for Us. And apparently talking about my faith and singing a song about the gospel is not only controversial, but it's divisive and it breaks standards on Facebook. It was cut. It's done. You can't even, the ending of it is cut off. Crazy. And I'm thinking, what
That's
kind of
crazy,
world?
Michelle.
Yeah.
Like when you think about like what else is on there, right? I mean, shoot, like, okay, so confession, like I enjoy local Dallas rap, right? I enjoy things from local artists in general.
Yeah.
This is not Dallas, but this is like Southern rap, but like 3-6 Mafia is a pretty popular rap group out there. But like, can you imagine like Late Night Tip is allowed on Facebook? Like you can play that kind of stuff, but you can't listen to Michelle sing because it's
divisive. Yeah.
But
you can see ridiculous. Things like WAP. It's
totally ridiculous.
And but yeah, right. You know, I'm talking about something, you know, how deep the Father's love for us and how great God is.
Satan shares and wags, like all over social media, right? Like, but then there's Michelle, guys. Watch out for her because she's
dangerous.
It's crazy. It's like, okay, so Facebook wants you to believe it's this champion of connection and free expression, but it's obviously not the case. The things that I really, Michelle, I see just as it's like right there in the windshield as we're driving towards it. These strong moves to literally just stifle all this diversity of thought, these consolidations of our traditional power structures. There are no checks and balances when you're literally bringing together the power of big media, big tech, big finance, and then also just very like-minded politicians who are benefiting from all of these institutions, whether it's financially or, you know, just exposure and relationships. I mean, they're all sort of like in it together against all of us. You know, the federal government is now competing with small businesses as an employer. And we saw that just with what Biden rolled out last week with his jobs plan. It's really insane. Like these moves to sort of redefine what free speech is in our country. Well, those moves aren't redefining it. They're just taking it away from us. You know, the ACLU, this was earlier in the year, they were warning of the unchecked power of these social media platforms after the Trump suspension. They were literally issuing a warning in response to the Trump's suspension from Facebook and Twitter. The fact is nobody elected these tech bros to make decisions for the country, like when it comes to what Michelle can sing and what she can't sing and what sort of awful rap music I can listen to or not listen to, or, you know, the things that we share online in general. I mean, shoot, we've got like our cousin talking about like their latest burp, you know, but Michelle's music is divisive. It's just where is the accountability too? You know, there's nobody taking responsibility for this stuff.
And there is the no accountability thing, and even the ACLU to come out with that, it is insightful because we tend to look the other way. Democrats, let's just talk about DC, will look the other way if it's benefiting them. Republicans will look the other way if it's benefiting them. We see that with laws and election standards and redistricting. You know, if it benefits me, it's okay. That level of standard goes back to Joe Biden taking God out of the National Day of Prayer and an ultimate right or wrong, not just I'm in it for the win, but I'm in it to do the right thing. We've lost that, and there is no right thing anymore or consistency on social media.
So Michelle, have you decided? Are you going to go and are you going to appeal your case to the Facebook Oversight Board? You know, like what are they going to say about this? You know, the Facebook Oversight Board, before they were even live, they literally had 150,000 cases that people had submitted to them for review. This Facebook Oversight Board is a quote unquote, like independent third party that's supposed to help kind of when Facebook's actual business team makes certain decisions about who to ban and who to censor and who to shut down. This oversight committee is supposed to be sort of like this third party counselor that says, well, Facebook leadership team, that was a good decision. Or, well, Facebook team, like you were a little hasty on this one, probably shouldn't have banned Michelle. And in a nutshell, this is a board of 20 people that come from different backgrounds. There are five Americans on this board out of the 20. And so when a case is submitted to this board for review, there's a guarantee that one of the, so let me tell you about the process first, right? So first, yeah. When a case gets to the board, it goes to a panel of five people out of the 20. So that panel of five reviews the case and they ask themselves a few basic questions about kind of what's going on here. Like, did the content that we're concerned about here violate Facebook's community standards and values? Yes or no? Did Facebook's removal of that content, did it respect international human rights standards, including freedom of expression and other human rights? Simple yes or no. They look at the nuances of language, because obviously a word in Texas might mean something than a word in New York, or, you know, slang, right, is a real thing. They look at the user intent of the post. They also look at the overall context in general, which might involve third-party information that the user didn't even contribute to or be a part of. And then they also look at the clarity of Facebook's terms. Are the rules that our users are being forced to conform to and comply with, are those easy to understand, or do they need to have like a family attorney tell them what these things mean? So after that first group of five people review the case, they make a decision that they will then send to the entire board for a majority vote. So that five-person panel is like, oh yeah, you know what? We think that Michelle's ban was ridiculous. We're going to submit our suggestion to the majority of the board, or to the board for a majority vote. And then that full group of 20 people will issue a vote of yes or no to certify that panel review. So, you know, in the case of these cases though, there is a requirement that one person in that first panel review be from the region in question. So, you know, you have basically a five-person panel. There are five people on the entire board that are from the U.S. So there's a guarantee that one of those Americans will be on the board, on the panel for your first review, right? The other four, though, they could be from anywhere else in the world, issuing their perspective on what they believe free speech is in the United States. So that's a concern, right? Like, someone from
Brazil
is going to feel differently than someone from America, than someone from, you know, parts of Europe or parts of, China. I mean, someone from a different country with a different background and also different legal definitions behind what free speech is, they're going to feel one way. You know, that's probably different from how maybe the entire the American people feel about free speech, right? So as things pertain to Michelle, I think that her problem is going to be this. She'll submit her appeal to the board, but they'll never review the case, right? Like January of this year, the board basically reviewed five cases after being issued 150,000 cases. So you have 20 people that are tasked with reviewing all of these cases. The thing is they've kind of functioned like the Supreme Court of social media. So they're only picking cases that are like President Trump's, you know, or things that they deem very socially significant, culturally relevant. They're being picky about which cases they're going to review. So it's unlikely that Michelle's ever going to get a nod unless we're able to help her go viral and really, really encourage the oversight board to review her case with some integrity. Mm-hmm. But the problem is how do we like reconcile the fact that this American business, Facebook, is able to redefine what free speech is and do so using kind of a social media Supreme Court that's not even American, right? Like
it gives you pause, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, because thinking about what Facebook has done historically, right? So we've seen Facebook cave to Russian censorship demands specific to the political opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. Navalny, by the way, is like, I think, pretty close to death because of how he's been treated by Putin. And I mean that seriously. Navalny used Instagram to expose corruption in Putin's government. And Facebook basically did what Putin asked and took that stuff down. Facebook caved to Turkey's President Erdogan, who found independent media sources that were critical of his government. He didn't like what those guys had to say, so told Zuckerberg, hey man, take that down. Facebook listened. And now here we are. We have Facebook and their leadership team using this oversight board as sort of a buffer to allow, I would say, political extremists in our country and a very, very biased media to basically go after the former president of the United States.
This oversight board is deciding, should we ban, should we keep him banned? Oh, maybe not indefinitely, but, you know, we'll put him in Facebook jail for 6 months or
Well, it's a cop-out too. They're like, well, you know, it wasn't right to indefinitely suspend him because he's kind of in limbo there. You know, so we're just going to ban him for another 6 months or so. And it's like, well, if the communist takeover hasn't happened by then maybe we'll let him out. But well, we're just going to kind of wait and measure temperature at that point, guys. This is crazy, craziness to me. When you think about the potential remedy to this kind of stuff, I've heard a lot of questions of, you know, well, is Congress going to regulate Facebook?
Yeah.
You know, who's going to sort of make an effort to protect our rights?
Right? And again, will Congress care under this administration? You know, I'm not trying to diss any party in particular, because I think both have some work to do. But will this administration and this particular Congress, being Democrat led, will they really care? Will they pretend to care? Will they really take action? And I'm going to go on a limb here and say probably not, because it's benefiting them.
You're right. And it's also because, so the funny thing is, Michelle, though, is like both sides of the aisle have expressed like a desire to change things. But, you know, it's like the thing is this, it's you're trying to change things in such a way that it doesn't cause harm to the public or the consumers. But it's like, it's such a big beast of a, I don't even want to call it a company, but it's like, it's a platform, you know, in function, but like, it's so much more than that. You know, if I make one change to the beast, then what's the result of that going to be? Like the gene therapy conversation. If I change this one gene, what are the implications for every part of my body?
Everything that's going to happen. But so there are some,
what to do.
There are some leaders that are taking charge in this, like, what is it? Florida.
Yep,
and
Florida, as my New York family said, Florida.
Florida. they're kind of leading the way and saying, okay, wait a minute. They are actually looking at keeping Facebook, YouTube, social media from the censorship of Trump. Is this a start? How does that work? How is that going to work?
Yeah. Well, you know, like with our congressional leaders, the kind of like the backlash kind of leading up to Florida doing what it's doing, but you know, with a lot of the moves that I guess some of our elected officials have been sort of recommending, a lot of regulation, things that could potentially harm private enterprise. And so a lot of people that are certainly more libertarian leaning and even some super conservatives are just like, hold up, wait a minute, don't go there because we ain't with it. Like, basically, hold on, guys. If you affect this private business, you might literally just kind of destroy the business, and that's not what we want to do. Florida has kind of basically observed as our lawmakers have tried to toy with the idea of really rewriting or redefining Section 230, which is that part of the FCC Act that gives online platforms, social media companies, this immunity from anything that users post. If you get rid of that entirely, then, you know, if I post something that's super profane to Twitter or Facebook, then someone who's offended by that can go and sue Twitter and Facebook directly for that. With that cloak of immunity, these companies are able to operate without that huge litigation risk. Mm-hmm. So the problem
which is fair. You know, totally think fair. About it because then you have frivolous lawsuits and, you know, and everybody's offended by everything. And if I say something, you know, someone real close to me got in Facebook jail for calling someone saying silly rabbit.
Yeah. That's for kids.
Yeah. Calling someone a silly rabbit, you're banned. You're banned for, you know, from Facebook. What? You know, because, well, you know, we don't want to use animals. It could offend someone. So, yeah, we totally get offended by stuff. And so there would be frivolous lawsuits. I get that. But I do think, though, on the banning of free speech, we really should be concerned. That's a fundamental right? It's fundamental to our existence in this constitutional America.
Michelle, there would be no George Carlin. There would be no South Park. I mean, there would be no Chris Rock, you know, like there'd be no Dave Chappelle. I mean, comedians, like, man, like you're impacting art with the degradation of free speech as well. And so Florida is really being, I think, a first mover here. And, you know, Governor DeSantis is a pretty smart guy. And so as he's kind of been sitting back watching the legislators talk about how to change Section 230 and not harm people, but make things better, but really making no strong or perfect recommendations, he's like, guys, let's just do this, right? Let's propose this. If big tech wants to ban political candidates, people who are actually running for office, okay, well, let's watch them do that. And we're going to fine them $250,000 per day, per ban, per person. As Facebook tries to basically sway an election by not allowing a candidate to be vocal or visible on social media. He's asking for big tech to basically publish explicitly detailed definitions of when someone should or could be censored or blocked.
I like that, Adam, because
let us know what's okay.
Having been in radio for many years, I've had to experience that there are regulations for having candidates on the air. If I'm going to interview a candidate or if we're going to have political commercials, for example, you have to allow the other candidate to have access as well. Now, I don't care if you're a left-leaning, ultra-left radio station and you want to put those ultra-left people on, you have to make room for the other candidates as well. Really, what are you afraid? If they really want to spend that money on your left-leaning radio station, right, which, you know, they're likely not going to swing a few votes there. Okay, that good for them. They're just giving you money. But that the idea is to say, don't close off everything. Get all of the facts so that you can be an informed voting public. The same idea or principle is being laid out here in Florida for social media.
Very much so. And the idea is this, and it's really simple: encourage competition, make users less reliant on a handful of services as we are now, because if you look for a competitor, well, we saw what happened there, right? Parler got taken down as Amazon said, you know what, we're not going to host you anymore. And then the next day, boom, Apple, Google followed suit and just literally got rid of the competition. So let's encourage competition. Let's encourage other outlets and other platforms to take hold of the public's attention and compete for engagement, and do so in a way that doesn't make online media cumbersome from a restrictions perspective, but it makes it a lot more accountable to the decisions that it makes to truly impact what should be a town hall conversation, a public forum, the same thing as Michelle playing the guitar on the sidewalk or me holding up a poster on the sidewalk. Social media should give us that layer of freedom and that same level of freedom as well.
Yeah.
Right now, that's not the case. If you're running for office and Facebook makes a decision to take your page down, or it makes more of a sneaky decision to reduce or limit the amount of impressions that your page gets to those constituents who you would seek the vote of, man, like that could seriously impact an election, especially when we see elections today that are so close. Local elections impact your school board. Your school board decides, you know, are we going to teach critical race theory, or are we going to actually teach education that helps our community grow closer and better together? So from impacting local elections to obviously also impacting federal elections, it's a huge deal. And we can't stand for it. We have to demand that we have more detailed definition around the terms of service that we are supposed to conform to when it comes to our activity on social media.
Indeed. Kudos to Florida. There are a handful of states that are making some decisions that are making people mad, but they tend to be towards more liberty and less restraint. And one final thing I wanted to get to was House Bill 1927. Hello, Texas down there. Give a wave there, Adam. You know, y'all are responsible for this one. It would get rid of the requirement for Texans to a controversial here. I'm sorry to my Seattle friends who are very, very scared of me going to a firing range and executing my constitutional right to keep bare arms and to shoot at a firing range. That was controversial. Scared you. I'm evil. I get it. But now you may not even want to go to Texas because this 1927 House bill would allow Texans to obtain a license to carry handguns if they're not prohibited by state or federal law. Possessing right, a gun. So in other words, you can it's a free for all. What?
Well, you know, what's interesting is, and I know this is going to be such a shocker, right? People that are law abiding citizens that carry guns generally don't break the law. And I know it's a funny sentence because I started it with law-abiding citizens, but I mean, that's just a matter of the fact, you know, when you have people that are obtaining firearms legally, going through the appropriate background checks, then there's typically not a problem. Now, right now, I mean, I'm a person, I have a license to carry. It required an FBI background check, fingerprints, all sorts of stuff, training as well. I don't walk around like I'm, you know, Walker Texas Ranger with a gun on my hip by any means. I think people try to be generally discreet about when they're carrying and when they're not carrying. You know, strategically, tactically, like, why would you want to reveal the fact that you're carrying? Wouldn't you rather the bad guys sort of like be fearful about who might be carrying, you know, and then they decide, oh, well, you know what, we're not going to commit a crime today because it might not turn out so well for us. You know, I think a lot of the moves that we're seeing from Texas, though, aren't so much about the guns themselves. They're more about really kind of being fearful of what the existing administration is doing. Also in response to how the administration is running the ATF, which I think Biden was calling the AFT, which is the American Federation of Teachers, not the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms Organization. There are some restrictions discussed that truly do not target the bad guys with guns. They target gun hobbyists, people that like to build guns because they enjoy building things, and probably guns they fire maybe once a decade, like literally. That's the kind of people, these are the kind of people that are being affected by the conversations that the Biden administration is having in respect of gun control. They're just the wrong conversations in general.
I think we should be having this conversation, though, because while it is, at, you know, like it or not, keeping and bearing arms, as I alluded to, is a constitutional right. It's a right. You shouldn't have, I mean, ideally with a right, I shouldn't have to have, I have the right to the pursuit of happiness. I shouldn't have to apply for a license for that, right? If we change that in the Constitution, yeah, I get it. But it really is baffling to me. Now, on the other end of that argument, I may have lost people to rage at this point, but I understand on the other end of the argument, though, if guns aren't licensed, we can't really trace them. It doesn't help in trying to solve crimes or to try to see where guns are coming from. If anyone can just have them, well, then, you know, maybe it's easier for the bad guys to get them. So you know, is there balance in there, or at least there's got to be a debate in there if we can get to the place where we can debate.
Right. Well, that's the point, Michelle. If it's a healthy debate, then it works. But if it's not a healthy debate, it doesn't work. Because if you do look at the statistics, it's going to bring some conversations around mental health for sure. Because the number one form of gun violence in our country is suicide. So it's a self-inflicted sort of violence. And that's a huge problem that is definitely worth a discussion. And then number two, the second biggest cause of gun violence is literally gang activity. Statistically speaking, when you look at the types of firearms that are being used, they're typically the cheapest of models that are out there. They're not firearms that we've probably heard discussions of ghost guns recently. Mm-hmm. Those are really, really expensive, by the way, because you're buying very specific parts. Like, it's like buying a car and it's like, oh, I want those kind of rims with this kind of audio system and that color, you know? So it's like, it's a really expensive way to get a gun. It's also a harder way to get a gun. Whereas you can just go find some super cheap POS gun on the streets for, you know, a couple hundred bucks versus the thousand that you might spend on one ghost gun when you put all the parts together, you know? So it's like, statistically speaking, well, I think we just need to look at statistics, right? Like, let's just see what the data tells us. And it's going to tell us that our conversations probably need to focus on definitely mental health and definitely also probably the gang violence and what's causing the gang violence.
Okay. So with, if we have the approach much like we have the approach to medicine, we just say, okay, we're going to give you this drug and suppress the symptoms and not talk about what's really at the heart, what is making you sick. That's where natural medicine is more of my jam, because it looks at you and says, okay, you have these symptoms. You know, what's your lifestyle? What are you eating? How are you interacting? How much stress are you having? What's really going on? How can we help your body heal itself? Not how can we suppress a symptom, give just pop a pill, easy fix, even though you may have, side effects like your brain is leaking out of your ear or your, you know, whatever. But
we do
the same thing with our politics, and we just say, well, we just need to ban guns. We need more gun control. We're not talking about the symptoms. How do we deal with mental health? How do we help people dealing with mental health issues? By the way, it's May, Mental Health Month.
Right.
Secondly,
What fuels a gang, right? What fuels the creation of a gang?
Okay, and we're looking at border issues where when we have these open borders and we are allowing the cartels who are behind a lot of the gang violence to have free access, make millions upon millions of dollars from these poor people who want to immigrate into the United States illegally. We are fueling that gang violence. We're not thinking about those things because we're so busy just popping the pill of simple gun restrictions and then thinking, we've done something good.
Yeah.
We feel better, but we're not healed.
That's 100% it, Michelle. And even this House Bill in 1927 coming out of Texas, right? It looks really controversial. It's like, oh my gosh, anybody can get a gun. Just come on over, get your gun. What this is trying to do is trying to help Texans enjoy Second Amendment rights and liberties that are in the Constitution. It's doing so recognizing that to get your license for a gun, it requires a federal authority to basically give you that permission. It requires that FBI background check. It requires the ATF to sign off on your ability to do so. So this is just kind of creating that separation between the federal government and the state government to allow Texans to enjoy these liberties lawfully. If the federal government chooses to impose or kind of trample on our Second Amendment rights in general, the conversations that we have around these kind of issues are really important, right? Like, we can't get around the reason for the conversation. Like, why do we talk about guns in general? Well, it's because of the result of certain situations that take place that are typically tragic, right? A mass shooting takes place.
Yeah.
What caused the mass shooting? Seriously, like, what caused it specifically? Let's not generalize about, oh, it's because there's guns that exist. Well, sure, yeah.
Well, no, we don't outlaw cars because drunk drivers run over kids and bicycles. That is tragic and it's ridiculous. But we're not outlawing people's rights to drive. We're not saying we've got to have less cars on the roads. We're not saying that because it's illogical. We want to deal with the people who make the decision to get in that car drunk. We want to deal with more than, as I said, popping a pill and saying, okay, I feel much better now because I'm hurting. I'm grieving with the nation over something so ridiculously tragic and horrific that I just want a simple fix. I just want to feel better. But it's not solving the problem.
Right. And mental health, right, Michelle? I mean, why is it that during the pandemic, the suicide rate among the school district in Clark County, Nevada, the suicide rate almost tripled from what it was before the pandemic. You know, you have kids feeling isolation. You have social media making people feel like they're ugly or they're not worth anything, you know? And what's fueling this degradation to mental health? We got to talk about that. The gun, in respect of suicide being the number one, I guess, result of, quote, gun violence, the number one cause, man, like, why aren't we talking about the fuel to that suicide? The gun was just the tool to someone who was feeling despair and desperate and alone. That person would have committed suicide with or without a gun. They would have found a way if that's truly what they were trying to do. Gun violence, why aren't we talking about, like Michelle said, obviously the border situation, which is going to, mark my words, give it 5 to 10 years, you're going to see a huge statistical increase in gang-related activity. But why aren't we talking about how intact family structures and religion help mitigate some of that? Education mitigates gun activity. We can do things and we can have really positive conversations that will actually reduce a lot of the worst parts of our society. We have the tools. We have, well, for now we have the tools. I mean, if we keep getting banned from Facebook, maybe that harms our ability a little bit, you know? But while we've got them, let's use them and let's make things better.
Let's make things better. And the conversations, and like the conversation we're having today, is giving us a little bit of another side, a little deeper conversation, including another point of view, is not going to kill our nation. It's going to strengthen our nation. And it's something that we really need to get to. And to me, I always like to get, you know, we excluded poor Joe, excluding God from the National Day of Prayer.
Come on, man.
Facepalm. Well, here we include the God story, because that deeper story is a story that gives us gratitude. It gives us hope. It brings us balance. It transcends left-wing, right-wing, Republican, Democrat. It is a powerful thing, and it's what we do on My Michelle Live. So if you think that this God story and the conversations that we're having is so good or important, then I ask you to like us, share us. You can go to My Michelle Live. You can donate there. You can even make it real fun and go scroll down to where we have some of the products from Real Bearded Men, from Calitren, which is a fountain of youth in the bottle. I promise you, lots of people losing. Yeah, right? Lots of people losing hundreds of pounds by taking Calitren, nice, slow, natural weight loss, and looking and feeling better. I love that. You can even connect to our product, which is going to be going down soon. It's a bidet, a spa for your bum for $50.
Nice. With, I almost heated bought water. One of those.
Oh, you need this ad. I'm telling you, literally. It is literally a spa for your bum. I mean, you think about it, when you take showers every day, you don't take tissue paper and go, okay, I'm clean. Right. I'm ready for the day. So why would you do that with your hind end?
Right. Just especially saying. If you live in Texas, man. I mean, the summertime here, woo. But just every time, man, like nothing like feeling confident, right?
There you go. So you can find all that at mymichellelive.com. Like us, share us, comment on us, help us to grow. We're still 5 months in and have grown exponentially. Thank you to all of you who are making this happen and helping us to spread a message of hope. So thank you so much. And Adam, my man, thank you for joining me for the Riz Report today.
Always a pleasure. You know, just I'm gonna work on my grito after this and just like see what I can do. You know,
let me see what you can do now. Come on.
Ripa!
I love it.
It's not quite like this one.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
for more fun, go to mymichellelive.com.
I think there's a cry style as well, which is just like next level grito.
You gotta do it. Hey, thanks, Adam.
Thank y'all.
And that's a wrap.